welcome to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, June 24th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. Let's start with the local weather. Today will be breezy with some sunshine and a high of 89 degrees. Tonight will be humid with a strong thunderstorm and a low of 67 degrees. Saturday will start with a thunderstorm in the morning and a high of 83 degrees. And now these local news stories. Iowa Dems make final plea for early caucuses. DNC to vote in September on the early nominating calendar. Tom Barton reports. Iowa Democrats argued Thursday the state offers a path to victory for long-shot candidates and opportunities for meaningful conversations with rural Americans and Iowans from every walk of life, as they made their pitch to hold on to their place at the front of the party's presidential nominating calendar. State party officials presented proposed changes for caucuses to the Democratic National Committee's Rules and Bylaws Committee in Washington in an effort to hold on to their first-in-the-nation status. Iowa Democratic Party Chairman Ross Wilburn told committee members Iowa presents a unique opportunity for presidential candidates to connect with voters distributed across urban, rural, and suburban areas in a presidential swing state where a majority of congressional districts are competitive. A robust Democratic nomination process in the state introduces voters to candidates and surrogates early, and the organizations they help build in Iowa keep us competitive in the general election, Wilburn said. Iowa is among 16 states and Puerto Rico vying to be included in Democrats' early presidential nominating window ahead of Super Tuesday in early March 2024. The DNC Rules Committee voted in April to reopen the presidential nominating window, forcing all interested states, including the current early nominating states of Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina, to apply for a spot. The move came after the current lineup of early nominating states, led by the largely rural and predominantly white states of Iowa and New Hampshire, came under increasing fire for a lack of diversity that many Democrats say doesn't represent the party's true strength. And it follows a chaotic 2020 caucus night for Iowa Democrats when a smartphone app meant to make reporting results easier failed. As a result, the official Democratic caucus results were not reported for several weeks. Iowa Democratic Party officials touted the state's pockets of diversity and argued Iowa serves as an inexpensive and accessible playing field for lesser-known candidates to establish themselves. There are diverse communities living, thriving, and dealing with complex political issues in both urban and rural areas of Iowa, Wilburn said. Party officials played a video of Black, Brown, and LGBTQ candidates and party leaders talking about their caucus experience and the importance of the Iowa caucuses. Iowa is the sixth least diverse state in the country. Wilburn, though, pointed to the urban demographics of Iowa's larger public school districts, notably Des Moines. The district, Iowa's largest, reported that among its 31,023 enrolled students in the last school year, 34.7% were white, 29.2% Hispanic, 20.6% Black, 8% Asian, and 6.8% multiracial, Wilburn said. When taken individually, these districts look a great deal more like America as a whole and reflect the future of Iowa, he said. He also cited figures from the Iowa State Data Center, stating 13 of Iowa's 99 counties have a Latinx population of more than 10%. Wilburn, too, told DNC members that it is essential potential presidential candidates be tested on their ability to communicate with rural voters across this entire population. One of the forms of diversity that Iowa brings, frankly, is the rural working class diversity. And it's a group of folks Democrats have forgotten how to talk to, Scott Brennan, a former Iowa Democratic Party chair and the only Iowan on the DNC Rules and Bylaws Committee, told the Gazette ahead of Thursday's presentation. And if we can't figure that out under the Electoral College system, we'll be doomed to win popular votes and lose the Electoral College. And that's criminal, and that's on us if we can't figure that out. National Democrats, too, have complained the party caucuses, compared with state primaries, are too opaque and inaccessible, requiring in-person attendance that can make them difficult for Iowans who work late shifts, lack access to childcare or transportation, or have health or mobility problems. To make their caucuses more accessible, Iowa Democrats proposed eliminating the requirement for in-person attendance and are reorganizing the caucus practice of identifying candidates' viability over multiple rounds. Under the proposed changes, an Iowa Democrat would request a presidential preference card in the mail and would have 14 to 28 days to either mail it back or return it in person caucus night. On caucus night, the Iowa Democratic Party would report the results publicly. The caucuses themselves would focus primarily on conducting party business, such as electing delegates. The state party also would contract with either a DNC-approved election vendor or with a county auditor or the Iowa Secretary of State's office to ensure a fair and trustworthy process. Iowa House Democratic leader Jennifer Confirst of Windsor Heights told the committee Keeping Iowa First would also help ensure Iowa Democrats stay competitive up and down the ballot, noting Republicans have already voted to keep Iowa at the front of the line in the GOP's presidential selection process. Every time a Republican candidate comes to Iowa and visits the district of one of my members or one of my candidates, they're building an organization on the other side, and they're building enthusiasm and engagement among voters, she said. DNC Rules Committee members also questioned how New Hampshire would react to the proposed changes and whether the caucuses would in effect function as a primary. New Hampshire state law requires its Secretary of State to set its presidential primary before any other similar primary contest. Iowa's caucuses have traditionally been different enough from New Hampshire's primaries not to conflict. Iowa code requires political parties hold caucuses at least 8 days before any other state's primary. It does not say how those caucuses must be conducted. We are focused on complying with our state law, which mandates that we are a caucus, Brendan told fellow Rules Committee members, and we believe that what we have proposed meets the requirements of state law. Members of the committee expressed appreciation of the Iowa delegation's proposed changes. I really applaud the Iowa delegation for a willingness to rethink the caucus process, one committee member said. I've been fairly critical about Iowa, so I think that was a needed recognition. The DNC Rules Committee is expected to meet in early August and recommend a slate of up to 5 states for the early nominating window. The full DNC would then convene in September to vote. Asked what Iowa Democrats would do should they lose their first-in-the-nation spot, Confirst replied, "We didn't come here to run for second place. We came here to be first and to remain first, and that's really what we're focused on," she said. SBA announces loans for businesses hurt by drought. Much of Siouxland has been in drought since spring. From Sioux City. The Small Business Administration is making available low-interest federal disaster loans of up to $2 million for small, non-farm businesses in the tri-state area that suffered from drought conditions this spring. The loans, which carry an interest rate of 2.94% for businesses and 1.875% for private nonprofit organizations, and a maximum term of 30 years, are intended to offset economic losses and reduced revenues that resulted from drought beginning April 15th, according to an announcement from the SBA. According to the U.S. Drought Monitor, most of Woodbury, Plymouth, Cherokee, and Buena Vista counties are currently in a severe state of drought, as are the entirety of Dakota, Dixon, Cedar, and most of Thurston County in northeast Nebraska, and most of Union and Clay counties in southeast South Dakota. Portions of Monona, Sioux, Ida, Clay, and a very small area in Sac County area are in severe drought, as is part of Wayne County, Nebraska, and Yankton County, South Dakota. Most of the area that is not currently in a severe drought is either rated as moderate drought or abnormally dry. The Small Business Administration makes economic injury disaster loans available when the U.S. Secretary of Agriculture designates an agricultural disaster. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack declared an agricultural disaster June 13th. Businesses that are primarily engaged in farming or ranching aren't eligible for SBA disaster assistance, the SBA said. An exception to this is nurseries, which are eligible for SBA assistance. Agricultural enterprises should contact the Farm Services Agency regarding U.S. Department of Agriculture assistance made available by Vilsack's declaration. The following South Dakota counties are covered by the program: Union, Clay, Yankton, Hughes, Jones, Millette, Potter, Sully, Turner, Bennett, Bonhomme, Dewey, Edmonds, Falk, Haken, Hutchinson, Hyde, Jackson, Lincoln, Lyman, McCook, Minnehaha, Stanley, Todd, Tripp, and Walworth. The following Iowa counties are covered by the program: Plymouth, Sioux, and Woodbury. The following Nebraska counties are covered by the program: Cedar, Dakota, Dixon, and Knox. Small non-farm businesses, small agricultural cooperatives, small businesses engaged in aquaculture, nurseries, and most private nonprofit organizations of any size may qualify for economic injury disaster loans of up to $2 million to help meet financial obligations and expenses which could have been met had there not been a drought disaster. Loan applicants may apply online or seek additional information at disasterloanassistance.sba.gov or by calling 800-659-2955 or emailing disastercustomerservice@sba.gov. The deadline to apply for the loans is February 13, 2023. Sioux City man charged with setting fire. Dolly A. Butch reports from Sioux City. A Sioux City man was arrested Wednesday after he allegedly started a fire inside Sam's Mini Mart on the city's west side. Orlando Castro, 63, was booked into the Woodbury County Jail in lieu of $25,000 bond on one count of first-degree arson and one count of second-degree criminal mischief. According to a criminal complaint filed in Woodbury County District Court, surveillance camera footage captured Castro entering the store at 923 West 7th Street through the front doors at 10:39 p.m. Wednesday and walking directly to shelves stocked with flammable automotive products. Nine other individuals were in the store at the time. The defendant carries an object in one hand and uses a handheld object in his other hand to ignite the first object, the complainant states. He immediately tosses the flaming object on top of the shelf and exits the store. On the footage, Castro can be seen wearing a black ball cap with a white logo, a red bandana face mask, a blue long-sleeve shirt with the sleeves pulled up to the elbows, black joggers with a white stripe, and white sneakers with dark markings. He also has a tattoo on his left forearm that spells out Castile, which was visible on the footage, according to the complaint. The complaint states that the owner of the business has known Castro personally for the past 3 decades and employed him for the past 3 or 4 months. The defendant was recognized by the victim, and he was subsequently located at his residence less than 2 blocks away from Sam's Mini Mart. The complaint states, at the time he was detained by officers, he was wearing the black joggers with a white stripe. He was further identified by the distinctive tattoo on his left forearm. When Castro was taken into custody, a cigarette lighter was found in his pocket, according to the complaint. Poultry shows are back. 4-H kids happy to see bird show ban lifted. From Sloan, Iowa, Nick Hytrek reports. All spring, Addie Johnson feared a repeat of 2015, when the poultry barn at the Woodbury County Fair featured none of her feathered friends. I'd go in there and look at the rabbits, and the other side was empty, and it was sad, Addie said. Avian influenza, or bird flu, had swept the state, forcing commercial producers to destroy millions of chickens and turkeys. To contain the spread of the deadly virus, poultry and bird shows across Iowa were canceled. Addie and younger sister Brenna faced a repeat of that sad situation this year. Bird flu again hit Iowa in March, eventually being confirmed at 19 sites, including 7 in northwest Iowa, and forcing producers to destroy hundreds of thousands of birds. On March 23rd, the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship canceled all live bird exhibitions at fairs. It was weird. I had like an empty feeling, Addie said. She and Brenna already were raising dove and golden pheasant chicks on their rural Sloan acreage for their 4-H projects. It looked like they wouldn't get the fun of showing them at the fair. I was sad, Brenna said. Our hope was to wait and pray we would have a show. On June 3rd, those prayers were answered. The state lifted the show ban after more than 30 days had passed since a new confirmed bird flu infection. The girls, both members of the Willow Workers 4-H Club, found out a couple days later at a 4-H awards banquet. Nebraska also has lifted a similar bird show ban. Addie and Brenna, who also show rabbits, horses, and dogs at the fair, and enter a number of other non-animal projects, will once again have a packed fair schedule, either showing their animals each day or helping friends with theirs. It would have been weird to have a day off without the poultry show, Addie said. Poultry and bird projects are among the most popular in Woodbury County, drawing approximately 190 entries last year, said Lugene Faber, the county's Iowa State University Extension and Outreach Youth Development Educator, who also oversees the 4-H program. When there aren't bird flu concerns, the poultry barn is filled with chickens of all colors and shapes, along with ducks, turkeys, and other specialty birds like Addie and Brenna's pheasants and doves. It's a popular roost for children and adults surprised to learn there are many more types of chickens than the stereotypical white hen and red rooster. I know when the public comes there, they enjoy seeing the wide variety of poultry, Faber said. So do Addie and Brenna. Their mother, Jamie, showed yellow pheasants when she was in 4-H, and their grandmother, Peggy Davidson, hatches golden pheasants and raises other birds. Addie, 17, and Brenna, 14, were attracted to the colorful birds from their first year in 4-H. Addie's shown bantams and fancy chickens in the past, and will show white doves and peach doves this year, her 7th in 4-H. Brenna was attracted to golden pheasants when she began 4-H 5 years ago. I like the pheasants because I think they're really pretty. I tried them my first year and thought they were pretty easy, so I kept with them, said Brenna, who will be a Westwood High School freshman. Both Addie and Brenna plan to show 4 birds at the fair in August, so there's much feeding, watering, and watching them develop champion-worthy plumage to be done. It's fun, said Addie, who will be a junior at Westwood, to hang out in the poultry barn answering questions from curious fairgoers who don't have an agricultural background. After facing the reality of being unable to exhibit her pheasants, Brenna said she learned not to take them for granted. Come fair time, she'll be among the hundreds of visitors appreciating the unique qualities of the different bird breeds. People get to see crazy birds they don't usually get to see, she said. I'm very excited. I love showing them. You could say it makes her proud as a peacock. And thanks to the lifting of the bird show ban, you might see a few of those too at this year's fair. And now these local news briefs. Big Brothers Big Sisters sets date for Bowl for Kids' Sake. From Sioux City. In early August, Siouxland residents will have a chance to bowl while helping fundraise for a nonprofit. Big Brothers Big Sisters of Siouxland is hosting its annual Bowl for Kids' Sake event at Rush Lanes in Sioux City on Friday, August 5th and Saturday, August 6th. According to a press release, teams of 4 or 5 bowlers will work to raise $500 or more for the organization, and then celebrate at the bowling alley on Stadium Drive. Brooke Dane, Director of Special Events and Community Partnerships, said the theme for the event is school spirit, and participants are encouraged to wear school-related attire to the shindig. We are so thrilled to host this again, Dane said via email, and the best part is all proceeds are going right back to the kids that we serve. Women killed in Thurston County train crash identified. From Walt Hill, Nebraska. Authorities have released the names of 2 women who were killed in a car versus train crash north of Walt Hill on June 13th. The Thurston County Sheriff's Office identified the women in a statement as Jenna Free, 51, and Jenica Brown, 21, both of Walt Hill. The crash happened at 3:36 p.m. at the railroad crossing at H Avenue and Highway 77. Free was driving a car eastbound on H Avenue when it was hit by a northbound train, according to the statement. Teen escapes attempted abduction from Sioux City. The Sioux City Police Department is searching for a man responsible for grabbing a 14-year-old girl. At 7:06 p.m. on Monday, the Sioux City Police Department responded to a report of a 14-year-old who had been taken by an unknown man, according to an SCPD press release. Responding officers located the teen at a business after she had jumped out of the vehicle and ran to safety. The teenage girl reported she was walking in the alley of 1400 block of Pierce Street when a Hispanic male in a gray pickup truck pulled up behind her and told her to get in his truck, according to the release. The man took hold of her wrist to coax her into the truck. Out of fear for her safety, the teen got into the truck. The man then drove the truck away until the teen jumped out in the area of 41st and Hamilton. The girl is safe at home with her mother, according to the press release. The police department is looking for a Hispanic man in his late 30s or early 40s, who is about 5'8" tall and about 180 pounds. He was described as barrel-chested and with a gap in his teeth. His truck is possibly a gray Ford extended cab pickup with branches in the back. Anyone with information on this person is encouraged to call the Sioux City Police Department. Food Bank of Siouxland receives $10,000 grant from Sioux City. The Food Bank of Siouxland now has $10,000 in grant money to put toward a program meant to address childhood hunger. On Wednesday morning, the 11-county supplier of food pantries and soup kitchens in Siouxland announced it had received funding from the Arby's Foundation for its backpack program, which provides a sack of food for kids who don't have enough to eat on the weekends. The program at present serves 10 area elementary schools, according to a press release. With this grant, we are able to feed more families of Siouxland, which is at the core of our mission at the Food Bank of Siouxland, Executive Director Jacob Wanderscheid said in the release. Thank you to the Arby's Foundation for selecting us. According to the release, this is the third straight year the Food Bank of Siouxland has been awarded money by the Arby's Foundation. The organization has plans to spend $500,000 in communities where Arby's has a restaurant. Judas Priest to bring tour to the Tyson, from Sioux City. Legendary band Judas Priest will bring their North American 50 heavy metal years to the Tyson Events Center at 401 Gordon Drive on November 1st. Best known for such heavy metal anthems as Sinner, Diamond and Rust, and Hellbent for Rust, Judas Priest is a Grammy Award-winning inductee into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Tickets will go on sale at 10 a.m. Friday at the Prime Bank box office or at primebanktix.com or tysoncenter.com. Texas man pleads not guilty of enticing Sioux City boy, from Sioux City. A Texas man has pleaded not guilty of enticing a 13-year-old Sioux City boy to have sexual contact with him. Isaac Herrera, 21, of Brownsville, Texas, entered his written plea Tuesday in Woodbury County District Court to charges of enticing away a minor and lascivious acts with a child. According to court documents, Herrera was outside East Middle School on June 7th and told staff members he was the boy's guardian and was looking for him. He then gave a fake name to an officer at the scene. Police determined Herrera had met the boy a year and a half ago while playing online video games. In an interview with police, Herrera said he had been in town since June 1st and had been hanging around with the boy and two other 13-year-old boys at a place he was renting, court documents said. A search warrant was executed on Herrera's phone, and communications between Herrera and the boy revealed conversations about the two performing sexual acts on each other. Herrera also had asked the boy to send him nude photos of himself, court documents said. And finally, Rossi man pleads not guilty of sexual abuse, from Spencer, Iowa. A Rossi, Iowa man has pleaded not guilty of having sexual contact with a girl approximately 6 years ago. Stacy Boss, 56, entered his written plea Wednesday in Clay County District Court to single counts of second-degree sexual abuse, lascivious acts with a child, and indecent contact with a child. The Clay County Sheriff's Office received a report in December from a girl who said Boss had abused her in 2016 when she was under age 10. According to court documents, the girl said Boss would ask her to tickle him and point to his crotch. The girl said she would touch him there while his pants and underwear were around his ankles. And now we go to stories in national and world news. Supreme Court expands gun rights. Jessica Greska reports from Washington. In a major expansion of gun rights after a series of mass shootings, the Supreme Court said Thursday that Americans have a right to carry firearms in public for self-defense, a ruling likely to lead to more people legally armed. The decision came out as Congress and states debate gun control legislation. About one quarter of the U.S. population lives in states expected to be affected by the ruling, which struck down a New York gun law. The High Court's first major gun decision in more than a decade split the court 6-3, with the court's conservatives in the majority and liberals in dissent. Across the street from the court, lawmakers at the Capitol sped toward passage of gun legislation prompted by recent massacres in Texas, New York, and California. Senators cleared the way for the measure, modest in scope but still the most far-reaching in decades. Also Thursday, underscoring the nation's deep divisions over the issue, the sister of a 9-year-old girl killed in the school shooting in Uvalde, Texas, pleaded with state lawmakers to pass gun legislation. The Republican-controlled legislature has stripped away gun restrictions over the past decade. President Joe Biden said in a statement he was deeply disappointed by the Supreme Court ruling. It contradicts both common sense and the Constitution and should deeply trouble us all, he said. He urged states to pass new laws. I call on Americans across the country to make their voices heard on gun safety. Lives are on the line, he said. The decision struck down a New York law requiring people to demonstrate a particular need for carrying a gun in order to get a license to carry a concealed firearm in public. The justices said that requirement violates the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. Justice Clarence Thomas wrote for the majority that the Constitution protects an individual's right to carry a handgun for self-defense outside the home. That right is not a second-class right, Thomas wrote. We know of no other constitutional right that an individual may exercise only after demonstrating to government officers some special need. California, Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Rhode Island all have laws similar to New York's. Those laws are expected to be quickly challenged. Governor Kathy Hochul, a Democrat from New York, said the ruling came at a particularly painful time, with New York mourning the deaths of 10 people in a shooting at a supermarket in Buffalo. This decision isn't just reckless, it's reprehensible. It's not what New Yorkers want, she said. Gun control groups called the decision a significant setback. Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice and an expert on the Second Amendment, wrote on Twitter that the decision could be the biggest expansion of gun rights by the Supreme Court in U.S. history. Republican lawmakers were among those cheering the decision. Tom King, president of the plaintiff New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, said he was relieved. The lawful and legal gun owner of New York State is no longer going to be persecuted by laws they have nothing to do with, that have nothing to do with the safety of the people, and will do nothing to make the people safer, he said. And maybe now we'll start going after criminals and perpetrators of these heinous acts. The court's decision is somewhat out of step with public opinion. About half of the voters in the 2020 presidential election said gun laws in the U.S. should be made more strict, according to AP Votecast, an expansive survey of the electorate. An additional one-third said laws should be kept as they are, while only about 1 in 10 said gun laws should be less strict. About 8 in 10 Democratic voters said gun laws should be made more strict, Votecast showed. Among Republican voters, roughly half said laws should be kept as they are, while the remaining half closely divided between more and less strict. In a dissent, joined by his liberal colleagues, Justice Stephen Breyer focused on the toll from gun violence. Since the beginning of this year, there have already been 277 reported mass shootings, an average of more than one per day, Breyer wrote. He accused his colleagues in the majority of acting without considering the potentially deadly consequences of their decision. He said the ruling would severely burden states' efforts to pass laws that limit, in various ways, who may purchase, carry, or use firearms of different kinds. Several other conservative justices who joined Thomas's majority opinion also wrote separately to add their views. Justice Samuel Alito criticized Breyer's dissent, questioning the relevance of his discussion of mass shootings and other gun death statistics. Alito wrote that the court had decided nothing about who may lawfully possess a firearm or the requirements that must be met to buy a gun, and nothing about the kind of weapons that people may possess. Today, unfortunately, many Americans have good reason to fear they will be victimized if they are unable to protect themselves. The Second Amendment, he said, guarantees their right to do so. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, joined by Chief Justice John Roberts, noted the limits of the decision. States can still require people to get a license to carry a gun, Kavanaugh wrote, and condition that license on fingerprinting, a background check, a mental health records check, and training in firearms handling and in laws regarding the use of force, among other possible requirements. Once again, you're listening to this reading of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, June 24th, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. And now we turn to today's obituaries. Kathleen A. Kathy Lance, 72, of South Sioux City, died Tuesday, June 21st. Services will be June 29th at 7 p.m. at Meyer Brothers Morningside Chapel. Visitation will be June 29th from 5 p.m. until service time at the funeral home. Chance Trudell Niles, 37, of Denison, Iowa, a loving husband, father, brother, cousin, uncle, and friend, passed away Thursday, April 28th, in Denison. The funeral mass was celebrated by Father Michael Cronin on Saturday, May 7th, at St. Rose of Lima Catholic Church in Denison, and burial at St. Rose of Lima Cemetery in Denison. Polly Jones Fennebecker Funeral Home in Denison was in charge of the arrangements. Chance was born on Saturday, June 30th, 1984, in Sioux City, and was baptized at Blessed Sacrament Catholic Church in Sioux City, godchild of Joan and Jean Dakers. Upon graduation from West High School in Sioux City, Chance worked with Cameron Construction alongside Troy Cameron. During that time, he had a daughter, Jada Navia, and a son, Aaron Dante. Chance earned his certification in auto mechanics from WITCC in 2015, and he had another daughter, Trinity Evelyn. Chance continued to work construction and became a member of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners of America Local 948 Union. On August 12, 2017, Chance married Martha Gomez Paz at Mater Dei Nativity Catholic Church in Sioux City. Godparents were Adrian and Martha G. Paz. Chance was a devoted family man who loved riding his motorcycle, grilling out on his Traeger, catching Pokemon, listening to music, watching movies, playing video games, and cheering on his 49ers. Chance was an avid outdoorsman who enjoyed boating, fishing, target shooting, and hunting. Chance was a jack of all trades and was open to teaching anyone who wanted to learn. He took pride in his work and was quick to lend a helping hand with a heart of gold. He was fast at making friends and quick to make a joke. Reverend James F. McCluskey, 79, of Wayne, Nebraska, died Wednesday, June 22nd. Services will be June 29th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Wayne. Burial will be at Calvary Cemetery in Newcastle, Nebraska. Visitation will be June 28th from 5 to 7 p.m. at the church. Arrangements are with Haysman Funeral Home of Wayne. Margaret M. McKenna, 86, of South Sioux City, died Saturday, June 11th. Services will be June 27th at 11 a.m. at Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Burial will be private at Logan Park Cemetery. Visitation will be 1 hour prior to service time at the funeral home. Beverly J. Kraft, 79, of Pleasant Hill, and formerly of Holstein and May City, passed away on Monday, June 20th, at the Genesis Senior Living Center of Des Moines. She took the train home, as her grandson said, with family by her side. Graveside services will be held at 10 a.m. today at the Liberty Cemetery of Calumet, Iowa, with Chris Friest officiating. Burial will be at the Liberty Cemetery of Calumet. Visitation was held from 5 to 8 p.m. on Thursday at the Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Holstein. The Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Holstein is in charge of the arrangements. Online condolences can be made at nicholasdjensenfh.com. Beverly Jean Kraft was born on July 15, 1942, the daughter of Robert Albert and Frances Vivian Peters in Hartley, Iowa. Beverly worked at Red's Cafe in Hartley. Beverly was a stay-at-home mom while her kids were growing up near Calumet. Beverly worked 26 years at Prairie View Nursing Home as a CNA-CMA until she retired in 2005. Beverly was united in marriage with Mickey Joe Kraft of May City on May 25, 1996, in Primgar, Iowa. They resided in their home in May City. Beverly was a member of the St. John's Lutheran Church in May City. Beverly enjoyed visiting with her family, sewing, quilting, coffee with May City Gang, camping, and riding with Mickey on his Goldwing. She is survived by her sister, Edna Shook of Spencer, her children, Jimmy L. Miller and his wife, Deb, of Schaller, Iowa, Mary Riesdorf and her husband, Rex, of Pleasant Hill, and Dale Miller and his wife, Brenda, of Calumet. She was preceded in death by her husband, Mickey Kraft, her first husband, Jim L. Miller, her parents, Robert and Frances Peters, her parents-in-law, Mildred and Elmer Kraft, and her sister, Shirley Miller. Marjorie Arnold Jividen, 97, of Sioux City, formerly of Merrill, died Thursday, June 16th. A celebration of life will be held June 26 at 3 p.m. at Rex Winkle Funeral Home in Lamars. Burial will follow the services at Hillside Cemetery in Merrill. Visitation will be June 26th from 2 p.m. until service time at the funeral home. And finally, L. Paul Tank Einck, that's E-I-N-C-K, 55, of Primgar, Iowa, died June 20th. Services will be private on June 26th at Eldridge Family Funeral Home in Primgar. Burial will be private at Calvary Cemetery in Primgar. Celebration of life will be June 26th from 12 to 3 p.m. at Primgar Community Building. And now these stories in national and world news. Panel hears from ex-DOJ officials. Group resisted Trump demands to investigate false election claims. Eric Tucker reports from Washington. Donald Trump hounded the Justice Department to pursue his false election fraud claims, striving in vain to enlist top law enforcement officials in his desperate bid to stay in power, according to testimony Thursday to the House panel investigating the January 6, 2021 Capitol riot. Three Trump-era Justice Department officials recounted a relentless pressure campaign from the president, including day after day of directives to chase unsupported allegations that the 2020 election was stolen. The officials said they swatted away each demand because there was zero evidence of widespread voter fraud. For the department to insert itself into the political process this way, I think would have had grave consequences for the country that very well may have spiraled us into a constitutional crisis, said Richard Donahue, the acting number two official in the final days of the Trump administration. The president, he said, had this arsenal of allegations. I went through them piece by piece to say, no, they were not true. Another witness, Jeffrey Rosen, who was acting attorney general, said he was called by Trump or met with him basically every day between December 2020 and January 2021, with the common theme being dissatisfaction about what the Justice Department had done to investigate election fraud. It all added up to a brazen attempt to use the Justice Department for his own political gain, said Representative Benny Thompson, a Mississippi Democrat and co-chairman of the January 6th committee. The panel also played recorded interviews of Trump aides saying that multiple Republican members of Congress requested pardons in the days after the riot. Testimony also centered on an Oval Office showdown on January 3rd, 2021, in which Trump contemplated replacing Rosen with a lower-level official, Jeffrey Clark, who wanted to champion Trump's bogus election fraud claims. Before the hearing began, it was revealed that federal agents this week searched Clark's Virginia home, according to a person familiar with the matter who spoke on condition of anonymity. The Justice Department has seemingly escalated its own probe of efforts to overturn the 2020 election. Feds. Maxwell deserves at least 30 years prison. Larry Neumeister reports from New York. British socialite Ghislaine Maxwell should spend at least 30 years in prison for her role in the sexual abuse of teenage girls over a 10-year period by her one-time boyfriend, financier Jeffrey Epstein, prosecutors said Wednesday in written arguments. Prosecutors said she should serve between 30 years and 55 years in prison, reflecting the federal sentencing guidelines. They made their recommendations to the judge who will preside over a sentencing hearing on Tuesday in Manhattan Federal Court. The 60-year-old Maxwell was convicted in December of sex trafficking and other crimes after a month-long trial that featured testimony from four women who said they were abused in their teens. Defense lawyers said in a sentencing submission last week that she should spend no more than 5 years in prison and shouldn't pay for Epstein's crimes since he was the mastermind and principal abuser and orchestrated the crimes for his personal gratification. Epstein took his own life in 2019 in jail as he awaited a Manhattan federal sex trafficking trial. But prosecutors said Maxwell played an instrumental role in the horrific sexual abuse and multiple young teenage girls between 1994 and 2004 at some of Epstein's palatial residences. They called her crimes monstrous. As part of a disturbing agreement with Jeffrey Epstein, Maxwell identified, groomed, and abused multiple victims while she enjoyed a life of extraordinary luxury and privilege. In her wake, Maxwell left her victims permanently scarred with emotional and psychological injuries, prosecutors wrote. That damage can never be undone, but it can be accounted for in crafting a just sentence for Maxwell's crimes, they added. Prosecutors also urged the judge to reject Maxwell's pleas for leniency on the grounds that she has suffered in extraordinary ways in jail while awaiting trial and afterward. Defense lawyers said she has faced death threats and harsh conditions that have caused her to lose hair and weight. Maxwell's appearance at trial proved those claims were wrong, prosecutors said, adding the defendant is perfectly healthy with a full head of hair. They said Maxwell has enjoyed remarkable privileges as a high-profile inmate that vastly exceed the benefits accorded to the average inmate. It is unsurprising that a woman who had led a life of incredible luxury should complain about her life as a prisoner, but that fact does not come close to meriting leniency at sentencing, much less the extraordinary degree of leniency the defendant seeks. Nuclear industry hopes to expand output, Jennifer McDermott reports. The U.S. nuclear industry is generating less electricity as reactors retire, but now plant operators are hoping to nearly double their output over the next three decades, according to the industry's trade association. The massive scaling up envisioned by the utilities hangs on the functionality of a new type of nuclear reactor that's far smaller than traditional reactors. About two dozen U.S. companies are developing advanced reactors, with some that could come online by the end of the decade if the technology succeeds and federal regulators approve. Utilities that are members of the Nuclear Energy Institute project could add 90 gigawatts of nuclear power combined to the U.S. grid, with the bulk of that coming online by 2050, according to the association. That translates to about 300 new small modular reactors, estimated Maria Korsnick, president and chief executive officer of the Institute. We have the innovation, we have the capability, we have the American ingenuity, she said. There's no reason that we shouldn't be able to bring these products to market. U.S. nuclear energy generation capacity peaked at 102 gigawatts in 2012, when there were 104 operating nuclear reactors, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. The nation's current 92 operating reactors have nearly 95 gigawatts of capacity. Their output totaled 778 million megawatt hours in 2021, which was 1.5% less than the previous year, and 19% of the nation's electricity, the Information Administration said. That's enough to power more than 70 million homes. It's costly and time-consuming to build huge conventional nuclear plants. A project in Georgia, the only nuclear plant under construction in the United States, is now projected to cost its owners more than $30 billion. When approved in 2012, the first new nuclear reactors to be built in decades were estimated to cost $14 billion. Korsnick talked about the possibility of doubling U.S. nuclear output in a recent speech to industry leaders and policymakers in Washington for the NEI's Nuclear Energy Assembly Conference, telling them that we're at a crossroads for our industry and the planet, and the response to the climate crisis is intrinsically tied to the electrical grid, economy, and energy security. The group applauded when she said 90 gigawatts of nuclear power could be added. Catherine Huff, Assistant Secretary for Nuclear Energy, spoke about U.S. priorities for nuclear energy and goals for a low-carbon economy. She said the only way to address the climate crisis is by working together. Korsnick, who spoke with the Associated Press exclusively before the conference, said it isn't wishful thinking. There's a demand for that much nuclear power as companies strive to meet customer expectations and fulfill pledges to cut carbon. There's significant interest at the federal and state level, and small reactors can be built largely in a factory setting, unlike traditional reactors. I apologize, but I seem to have lost internet service, so no sports stories for today. But that does it for today's reading of this edition of the Sioux City Journal for today, Friday, June 24th. I'm your reader, Mark Bedford. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And thanks for listening.